And to inspect the apartment, they found a lot of things not working out. And after several times sending her letters to repair things and not doing anything about it, the city got her to court, not me.
Okay, thank you, gracias. We're going to have to throw it back. I'm sorry. There's more people here who want to talk to us, but we've just run out of time. I'm sorry. This is the Homelessness Marathon, and we've been hosted here by City Life Vida Urbana. Thank you to Steve Meacham and Andres de Castillo. And Gabriela, what's your last name?
Herrera.
Thank you so much. I throw it back to the studio now.
The views and opinions expressed on this broadcast are not necessarily those of the hosting or affiliated radio stations, their personnel, or underwriters. To contact the Homelessness Marathon, write to questions@homelessnessmarathon.org. Welcome to the 21st Annual Homelessness Marathon, America's Town Hall on Homelessness. The number to call in is 877-NOBODY-8. That's 877-662-6398. We welcome your perspective, whether it is the same as ours or not, but we do want you to know what ours is. Our view is that...
I was never cool in school. I'm sure you don't remember me.
And now it's been 10 years. I'm still wondering who to be.
And I'd love to mix in circles, cliques, and social coteries. That's me. Hand me my nose ring.
Can we be happy?
Show me the mosh pit.
Can we be happy?
We can be.
What's up? I'm Virgil, and next up is the Cable Youth Collective. This month's theme is bad, and our first piece we'll be playing today is an interview by Jack. So, with that in mind, everybody enjoy.
Hi, I'm Dania Factor. I'm a public relations intern from Passion Impact, and I'm here with my team, and I'm here to talk about what Passion Impact is.
Yeah, so my name is Cameron Vassad.
My name is Bell Payne T, but I go by Bell.
And yeah, for those who don't know what Passion Impact's about, it is a nonprofit that focuses on engaging youth primarily from high school and community colleges to volunteer out in the community. By doing this, it'll be an opportunity for them to network and develop lifelong skills to apply to the career world and education. Ages go around from 14 to 26, but there's no really limit to volunteering with us. And to go on the topic of how we got here to this position today, I want to ask a little bit about how did everyone become a part of this public relations intern, and why you chose this position?
Well, I got it from you, actually, Cameron. You're at PCC, I'm at PCC as well, and then, you know, I just happened to tell you as well, and then you gave me an opportunity to show me that I wanted to volunteer more often.
Yeah,
saw that I had something in me.
I showed him the light, the new gateway to volunteering.
Exactly.
Okay, that was a little weird. Sorry about that. But yeah.
Yeah.
And Danya, how about you? How did you become?
Well, I mostly started, since I'm in high school, I'm still in high school, I go to Franklin High School, and they were doing volunteering work at the school, and I just decided to just sign up because it was in the cafeteria, and I'm normally there. So yeah, and then Stefan, the supervisor of Passion Impact, from the public relations internship. He's just like, hey, do you want to join? I'm like, yes, I want to join. Like, I've been looking for something like this for a while. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, I was quite curious what it was, what I was gonna do. So
yeah,
for me, well, this is something different. Well, something I never really thought about doing before. Because for me, for example, I worked at a restaurant, and then I really never thought about interning for a volunteering.
As interns, we are titled as public relations intern, where we are basically marketing through social media and on volunteerism, getting like students, youth, the student youth and adults to get engaged in the community and like help give them a kindle of passion for themselves. For those who know or don't know, this is a great way to like explore yourself in
so kind of like networking.
Yeah, in a sense, yes. Basically, yeah, it's networking. Okay. Yeah. For my part on how I became a part of this, of Passion Impact and how it led up to here, it's a kind of a long story, but to put it in short, before I joined Passion Impact, I was first introduced by a friend of mine. His name was Elijah, and he brought me to this club, and I didn't really know. I just blindly walked into the club. I'm like, okay, he's a good friend of mine. This was in sophomore year of high school at Franklin, and I was led to a whole new world of volunteering from here on. I've ever since sophomore year, which is now 2019, 3 years, 2.5 years from now, I think.
So you accumulated a lot of hours.
Yeah, I built up from being a volunteer for a volunteer fair program to an intern at Passion Impact. And nice. Yeah, this summer.
Yeah, so basically going back to how we got involved, we just all have different ways how we got involved.
Maybe like a couple of years ago, this is something I would never actually, you know, thought about doing. Mm-hmm. But here I am today with...
So let's talk about the benefits of volunteering, you know, because there's so many benefits that we can really get into.
Yeah, there's a huge list of benefits to volunteering, and we can go on and on about it.
But to
name a few that personally I can like come from and say is quite significant. Of course, a lot of other skills, hard, soft skills are quite significant. But for me, I can say that volunteering for the past 2.5 to 3 years at Passion Impact, I've been able to develop not only networking with new and old friends, but gain a skill of interpersonal skills, organizational skills, team building skills, and so on and so on.
Yeah, a couple of them are the same for me too. Like networking, you know, I wanted to build that up on my resume. There's a lot of benefits to volunteering.
Yeah, so many. Yeah, mostly for the people that, you know, have jobs and have no hobbies or looking for new hobbies, you know, volunteering is also a great way to go out there.
Yeah, it's a great way to explore.
Explore, yeah. Yeah, so if everybody wants to join Passion Impact, we have our own...
We have an email that you can, you know, email us questions on how to get involved.
Through communication at passionimpact.org and a website called passionimpact.org. So give a chance to support the mission of this nonprofit that has given us so many memories and skills that I can't even start naming them because there's so many of them. I mean, I could, but that's too many of them. But yeah, if you're interested in supporting, you can donate on passionimpact.org. And if you have any questions on how to get involved with Passion Impact, or to find an outlet to look for more volunteering opportunities, you can email us at...
communication@passionimpact.org.
Yeah, communication@passionimpact.org. That'll directly email towards us, public relations interns, and we can help guide you a little bit from there.
And yeah, so basically, if you like to work in a team or you have any skills that you can bring through volunteering, this would be a great place where you can volunteer at Passion Impact.
Yeah, it's not just like, you don't have to really work with Passion Impact. It's just a way for us to...
It's more like a network.
Yeah, we're like... I don't want to say it like this, but it could be like a middleman. Like, we will guide you or lead you towards more volunteering opportunities in the community at Portland.
Yeah, there's a lot of different type of, you know, volunteering events all around Portland.
Yeah, there's a huge variety.
Yeah.
If you have any more questions, not only regarding about volunteering, but you can email us at communication@passionimpact.org. Mm-hmm. So it goes, everything you need will reach back to you through that email, and more information will be provided. At the moment, we're still planning things out through the month, so.
Yeah, so once again, communication@passionimpact.org.
I'm Belpang Teeth.
I'm Cameron Vassad.
And I'm Dania Factor.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to us, and hopefully we see you at one of our volunteer events.
Yeah, that'd be great.
All right, thank you.
There was a mix-up with that last piece. That was not Jack's interview. That was an interview with a passion project that they did themselves. And next up, we have a piece by Sylvia Kaz and Calvin, and it's about, well, we'll let them tell you. Enjoy.
All right, so for our theme of bad, we are going to be talking about good and bad movies, and we're going to talk about the specific qualities that makes a movie good, bad, or just kind of neutral. I'm Calvin.
I'm Kaz.
I'm Sylvia.
So I think I'm just going to start out reading some of my good movies. So the two good movies I picked were Sorry to Bother You, which is about a black telemarketer who learns how to speak in a white voice and becomes wildly successful. It's a great race movie and capitalism movie. It's a critique of society, and it's really, really surreal and interesting. And then my other movie is Into the Spider-Verse, which is an animated movie about Spider-Man, and it is visually stunning, and you know, the plot's really good too.
I picked for my good films, I chose the movie Clue. It's a movie about blackmail, and it has some weirdly heavy themes for something that is rated PG. As far as technical execution goes, it's fairly poorly done, but it's still very fun to watch, and the themes make it interesting regardless of actual filmmaking quality.
For my good movies, I picked Thor Ragnarok, which I think is probably like one of my favorite Marvel films. I think it's a lot of like the comedy in Marvel actually doesn't like appeal to me very much, and I think as a superhero movie, it doesn't take itself like too seriously, and I really like that. And I also think that like the characters are just amazing. And so my second movie is Us, and as it is Jordan Peele's second movie, it's really well done. I think it's got like a lot of depth. Like after the movie, you can look back at it. Us has fantastic plot twists. It has like depth to the quote unquote villains, and I think it's just a unique horror movie that is very well done.
I haven't seen Us, but I've seen Get Out, and one of the things I really liked about that one was that there was kind of a really strong takeaway, and that's another reason why I like my good movies, Sorry to Bother You and Into the Spider-Verse, is that both of them, when you were done watching them, you were remembering parts of it in your head, and you were analyzing parts of it in your head, and both of them had very strong messages, and especially Into the Spider-Verse, that was like, the movie was visually and just like plot-wise, it was a work of art. Like, it was all coming together for like one purpose, the message that like anyone can be Spider-Man, and like Spider-Man's universal, and that like he's in all of us, and or you know, she or they, like it's very like welcoming for anyone to relate to the character. And that's something that I think is great about Spider-Man as one of my favorite superheroes, and I think this movie portrayed that really well.
I also watched Spider-Verse, and I also appreciated it a lot. Towards the end of the film, without giving anything away, the animation style gets very like experimental, and it's very interesting to watch because throughout the film, they already lowered the frame per second for the film, and they used different methods for shading, like hatching and cross-hatching and pointillism, to create depth. And by the end, they're using all of these bright neon comic book colors to show what they can do with the medium of animation that really hasn't been used in other films. And it's really amazing to see because it provides that bit of inspiration for artists and designers, because it's just nobody's done that in animation before, at least in like very popular culture. It's not it's kind of unheard of.
Yeah, I also think it was really good. Like the animation was a direct reference to the comics, and being someone who grew up reading a lot of comics, I really appreciated that.
Yeah, definitely, especially since like, yeah, animated films these days, or I guess most animated films, haven't really been taking full advantage of their medium. Like, there are a lot of like live action things trying to replicate the exact effects of comic books, but I think that just using like really stylized drawings like they did in Spider-Verse, I think like sticking with the style in that way can produce some really cool results.
Yeah, and another thing is that you said about Thor Ragnarok is that it didn't really take itself too seriously, and it knew like that it was a silly superhero movie. I also saw that in Into the Spider-Verse, and that's one of the real reasons that I loved it so much, was because I think that it knew that it was sort of just light entertainment, and it wasn't super heavy, like, you know, Batman versus Superman. Like, It knew that it was fun, and not like, it wasn't trying to be like, this is a really dark commentary on humanity. It was
the stakes were low.
Yeah, well, the stakes were high in the plot of the movie, but for the audience, we weren't all depressed afterwards.
Yeah, no, it had a lighthearted ending, even though it dealt with some like serious themes.
And then back to like the idea of the colors used in Spider-Verse, like you can also see how colorful Ragnarok was as far as like comedy films. One of the best things to see in them, at least for me, is that presence of color and beautiful design, because as somebody who's like really drawn to design, I'm kind of like a moth in that way, where I just kind of gravitate towards color and light. It's very nice to see because it provides that sense of happiness and joyfulness, whereas less saturated things will appear more gloomy. So to see a comedy film that takes advantage of the like wide range of colors that you can capture on camera, it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah, I think that in a way, one quality of good movies that I think we'd all agree with is that the cinematography and the colors and everything matches the mood and the plot of the movie, and that becomes a major contributing factor, because like in Sorry to Bother You, it was incredibly surreal, and there are all these like weird moments where you're like, there's one character who her earrings change from every scene, and they're always just this weird surreal thing, and there are always these billboards in the background, and you pause it and you find weird Easter eggs, and they're all contributing to the like the message of the movie, which is basically that capitalism is like bad for your soul. What did you think about the cinematography in Clue? What was there in that regard?
While watching it, I did see that while not being filmed very well, the framing was actually, for the majority of the movie, was pretty spot on. It managed to, while not taking advantage of angles or anything, it more just managed to get a shot where you could see everything that you needed to see, and it did the job. It was kind of subpar in that category, but I feel that despite that, the character design and the costume design And just the way that all of the actors interacted with each other was a great way to make the film still engaging.
So I think that you're saying that a movie does not have to be 100% perfect to be good.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if, like, I mean, some aspects of the movie can totally outshine the others. Like, there are a lot of, I mean, like, it doesn't, even if the technical, like, cinematography of a film isn't great, it can still have, like, wonderful actors, and it can just generally be entertaining. Like, some movies can, like, I think people should probably, like, enjoy movies more for, like, the fact that they're just fun to watch, even if there are plot holes and, like, character development that might not necessarily make a lot of sense, they can still just be entertainment.
Yeah, a lot of what makes a movie good is just how it makes you feel.
Yeah.
That was Kaz, Sylvia, and Casper talking about movies, and next up is a piece by Andrew on what makes an action bad. Enjoy.
What makes an action bad? It's a pretty big question. People have probably been trying to answer it since there was society and a lot of free time. Since I've got a pretty significant amount of free time myself, I figured I'd look into it. Obviously, I didn't exactly solve it, or even make any significant headway, or else I'd be writing a research paper and not talking to you about it. But I did educate myself a little bit on the topic, and it's pretty interesting, so I'll share what I found with you. There are, well, many schools of thought on this, but there are two big and well-known ones: deontology and teleology. Let's start with teleology. Teleology is the idea that what matters in a decision is the outcome. Utilitarianism is probably the most well-known teleological moral structure. This is the idea that the ends justify the means. Now, that doesn't mean that you can commit heinous crimes to get an ice cream cone. The net benefit there is still, obviously, negative. Even in each of these groups, there are some structures that hover between, and there is variance within each of the two. The greatest happiness produced, for example, could be how your actions affect the universal happiness of every person, or it could be whether your actions produce the greatest happiness for you personally. Even those that strive only to improve their own ethics could fall into this category, as they do it for the feeling of improving and becoming a better person. In both of these senses, some can view it as incredibly selfish, and others as incredibly selfless. What matters from a decision is the action and not the consequences. One of the main proponents and developers of deontology is Kant. His reasoning is that the only absolutely good thing is a good will. Deontology focuses on the virtues and motives of the person performing the action, rather than the consequentialism of teleology. At a glance, this seems like a more noble option, but it has its flaws as well. It often doesn't resolve problems between two absolutes, say, never lying and protecting a friend. Both of these structures are incredibly interesting takes on both human behavior and ideal human behavior, and there is no way for me to fully explain both of them in this segment. I strongly suggest you look into it yourself, as most people don't strictly follow one or the other, and it doesn't hurt to find out what resonates most with you. Thanks for listening, and have a great night.
That was Andrew, and next up is a review of bad movies by me and fellow Youth Collective member James. I would just like to note that the quality of this next piece is rather subpar. However, that is simply to fit with the theme bad, and you should absolutely not question that at all. Enjoy.
What's good? My name is Virgil. I'm here with my dear friend James, and today we're going to be reviewing some terrible movies.
Quick disclaimer, this piece does include spoilers, so if you have not watched The Room, the entirety of the Santa Claus franchise, or the Wild Thornberrys movie, and do not wish to have their plot spoiled for you, proceed no further. The first movie we'll be reviewing is The Room, directed, produced, written by, and starring Tommy Wiseau. I can feel my soul already being ripped apart.
As can I. To grossly simplify, The Room is about a love triangle. The main character is Johnny, played by Tommy Wiseau. He's a banker who overall has a pretty good life in his San Francisco apartment bedecked with erotic spoon artwork, where his girlfriend Lisa hangs out. Unbeknownst to him, however, Lisa has been secretly hooking up with his best friend Mark.
Chaos ensues, as well as many mind-boggling subplots, including everyone playing football for absolutely no reason, Lisa's mom randomly announcing she has breast cancer and then the film just dropping it, a random couple hooking up in Johnny's apartment, and Denny, Johnny and Lisa's weird child roommate who also wants to hook up with Lisa for unexplainable reasons.
The movie ends with Johnny discovering that Lisa has been hooking up with Mark and proceeding to lock himself in a room, hump a dress, and then off himself. No, it doesn't make more sense if you've watched the movie.
Altogether, this movie is absolutely awful. However, while it possesses zero redeeming qualities as far as being a decent film goes, it does have some amount of value as a movie to watch ironically. It's so positively terrible that it loops around all of a sudden and becomes somewhat entertaining.
With all of that in mind, we rate The Room 5 Tommy Wiseau nipples out of 10.
Next up on the hit list is Disney's Inconsolable Santa Claus franchise. This family of films centers around the machinations of Santa's workshop, a totalitarian kleptocracy where supreme control is held by the titular Red Man himself. The dictatorial position of Santa Claus is passed on entirely through state-mandated assassination. When one Santa Claus begins to show weakness and is eventually murdered during their yearly duty of delivering presents across the world on Christmas Eve, the mantle of Santa Claus and the responsibilities that come with it are transferred to whoever struck the killing blow and donned his suit.
Thus, this system ensures the workshop is only governed by the most cunning and brutal members of the mortal race. Subservient to whoever holds Santa's title are the elves, a caste of child slaves cursed with immortality who are doomed to eternally serve in the workshop's churning toy-making foundries nestled deep beneath the North Pole.
The film begins following Scott, played by Tim Allen, who's been given custody of his son Charlie on Christmas Eve so he can spend the holidays together. So they can spend the holidays together. When Scott ventures outside at the hour of midnight, he sees Santa landing on his roof. He understandably panics and shouts at the sudden intrusion, which startles the Red Man, thus causing Santa to tumble down from the roof and die instantly. Then, because Scott suddenly becomes a moron, he dons Santa's outfit, steals his sleigh, and goes to deliver the remaining presents. Before long, the flesh and bone comprising his body is gruesomely warped and twisted into a shape resembling the Saint Nicholas who wore his suit before him, and the audience can only watch helplessly as they are slowly ripped away from the Scott they once knew and loved.
In the second film, the plot revolves around him having to kidnap a random woman to serve as his Mrs. Claus for some reason. The third film is essentially Rise of the Guardians if it were worse in every way beyond comprehension. The Easter Bunny, Mother Earth, and a bunch of other characters from Claus folklore venture to the North Pole and are like, "Bro, stop being so cringe, or we'll take away your Santa powers."
If one were permitted one saying to describe the horror of the shameful Santa Claus franchise, it would be, "The devil is in the details." For the sleeplessness arrives after pondering the questions these interconnected films raise. After all, what happens when a Santa dies and no one slips into their suit? Does the childlike wonder of Christmas cheer finally die off as presents fail to show up beneath the trees of countless anxious kids? And do the elves toiling away beneath the frigid ice know their faceless master has perished? Or are they simply doomed to eternally praise and serve the machines which control them?
Overall, we rate this franchise 1 out of 10 for too much disturbing talking reindeer scenes. Burn this film immediately.
The next motion picture we will be reviewing, nay, Beholding is 2002's The Wild Thornberrys movie, the physical manifestation of my nightmares. Based on the hit medieval torture device known as the Wild Thornberrys animated television series and produced by known arbiters of abyssal terror Nickelodeon in collusion with the demonic priests of the Order of Klasky Supo, the animated show this atrocity is based on consists of 91 episodes of pure agony and suffering. Starring Nigel Thornberry, a psychotic Englishman who is the host of a popular nature program known as Nigel Thornberry's Wild World. He treks the Earth to film its episodes with his wife and photographer Marianne, his oldest daughter Debbie, his younger daughter Eliza, pet hatal beast Darwin, and feral humanoid child named Donnie.
The show revolves around the titular Thornberry dynasty and their assortment of demonic servants traveling the flat disk that is the Earth, filming their televised nature documentary. The show's main character, Eliza, and the youngest daughter of Marianne and Nigel, is endowed with the magical ability to commune with animals, including her pet chimpanzee, Darwin. However, because the universe is dumb and we are all doomed to suffer a painful death, Eliza will lose her powers if she ever reveals them to another human, which leads to her getting herself in more trouble than is necessary. Most of the episodes revolve around her adventures around the globe, I mean Frisbee, as her family burns and pillages their way into all seven circles of hell.
The movie essentially takes everything the show executes and shoves it into an eternal hell disguised as a 90-ish minute theatrical feature. Nigel Thornberry, Lord of all that is unholy, desires to film a herd of elephants migrating across Africa for a special episode of his wildlife program. Therefore, the whole family embarks upon the journey down in their personal motorhome. But when they make a stop on the plains, a cheetah cub Eliza visits with is suddenly kidnapped by poachers. Eliza unsuccessfully attempts to stop them and nearly gets herself mildly injured in the process. Thus, her family decides all of a sudden that this is enough, and she is riven from the life she knows, shipped off to a boarding school in England as a way to keep her out of trouble or some equally bad excuse to prevent your daughter from being a decent person. Eliza, however, does not want to be in boarding school at all. The majority of this film revolves around her trying to get out of boarding school and back to Africa in order to save her little feline minions.
This film ruined my life. What words in the myriad of human languages are suitable for expressing the eternity of inscrutable cosmic torture that is the Wild Thornberrys movie? There are none. It is impossible for me to properly portray to you just how soul-sucking, disgusting, depraved, and just downright awful this movie is. This movie broke into my home to ransack it for all of my valuables, and then left me alone with my life in shambles. And if you aren't careful, it will do the same to you in due time. Run away fast while there is still hope for you. Do not let these words infect your mind with the insatiable desire to witness what is not suitable for the human mind like was done to those before you.
Do you want to know, to truly experience, to behold the Wild Thornberrys movie? Do you think you know who you are? Do you think your life retains some semblance of purpose, loosely crystallizing into a reason for existing beyond the confines of the mortal shackles chaining you to this dying world? You shall fall prey to the order taking root in your mind as they twist the ratcheting gears of the cosmic hands of fate. For they hunt beyond the confines of space-time. Though it may appear to have scarred our world more than a decade ago, the unholy magics dripping into our burning reality flow into rivers of blood and tears before our very eyes as we speak. The ferryman keeps quiet, for he knows that we shall never be free so long as the puppets on the arms of this infernal machination continue to tighten our chains until all we can do is gasp for air and look upon all that which we have defiled upon this maltreated realm in our fleeting time on it.
Well, that's all, folks. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next month for more family-friendly fun. This has been Virgil and James for the KBOO Youth Collective.
Thank you very much, Virgil and James. That was spectacular. Next up is an interview done by yours truly with a local Portland graphic novelist.
My name is Jackson Flowers, and I'm here with the Youth Collective at KBOO, and here with an author. So if you could just introduce yourself and maybe give a brief synopsis of your book.
Oh, boy. Sure. My name is Dylan McConis. I live here in Portland, and my book is called Queen of the Sea. It's a graphic novel for young adults. It's about a little girl who grows up in kind of an Elizabethan Tudor period on a little island out in the middle of the sea with a bunch of nuns. And then things get real exciting from there.
Okay.
Awesome. I don't want to spoil anything.
Well, so just opening question. How did you first start getting into graphic novels? And you start with like drawing first or writing? What was your entryway into the whole world?
That's a good question. I was just one of those kids who always drew stuff and mm-hmm. wrote stuff. I just never stopped. And I'm a control freak. Comics is really good if you don't want to share any decisions with anybody else. If you can both do the writing and the art, mm-hmm. You can really control the entire process from beginning to end. I like not being dependent on anybody else for help.
So how does that connect to like the publishing and such with being, are you in control for the most part, just as like going through the process of publishing a book?
So I've totally self-published books before. Okay. I started out doing webcomics, and I still mm-hmm. do webcomics, where it was completely me. I mean, like hand-coding my own HTML and scanning in my own pages and everything. It was very early aughts. And I've also worked with comics publishers. This is my first book with a New York publisher. They're actually based in Boston in the UK. But it was actually really nice to not be mm-hmm. in charge of everything, just the parts I really super enjoy and am really, really invested in. But it was really cool to like not have to design the barcode for the back of the book. I was happy to let somebody else do that part.
Okay. What was the first? You mentioned the webcomics. Was that the first thing that like you published? And how did that start? Was it like college or that kind of thing?
I started in high school. It was my senior year of high school. I had a lot of free periods that year, so I obviously abused them. And I did like early admission to college, so I wasn't stressed out about that after winter break, apparently. I started a comic called Bite Me, which is a really great thing to have on your resume as a 35-year-old. It's like, yes, my first opus, Bite Me, which is about a crew of really useless vampires trying to escape the French Revolution. It was very silly. It was done totally on a lark, but it ended up being a whole book, and I finished it in my junior year of college.
That is really impressive and really awesome.
Oh, thank you.
So Queen of the Sea does seem a bit different than your earlier graphic novels.
A little bit.
What made you want to tell this particular story?
Whole bunch of stuff. I really don't like doing autobiography because I think I am super boring as a subject. I'm an introvert. I hang out at a desk and I draw pictures all day, so there's really not a whole lot to report. But I definitely spent a lot of time alone as a kid inside my own head, and this is a story about a kid who spends a lot of alone time inside of her own head. So it was kind of an excuse to pull up some of that autobiographical stuff about being a weird 11-year-old and try to translate it, but with the safety of it being a totally different world and a totally different set mm-hmm. of circumstances. And I thought the historical period was really cool. I was nerding out over a lot of like YouTube videos about the period. So like, what if I combined these things?
So overall, what do you think like your favorite part was while working on Queen of the Sea?
Ironically, a lot of parts of making comics are awful, which is funny because there are so many parts and you have to repeat things so many times. But this whole book is watercolored, which a lot of cartoonists look at me when I tell them that and they ask me if I'm okay, like if I've suffered some trauma recently that drove me to this. But it was really meditative. I loved the part where I just had to watercolor 400 pages in a row because it was it was chill.
That's impressive. I've tried once or twice, and it's...
Well, but you know, you can't like, check your email while you're watercoloring, because it dries really quickly. You have to move mm-hmm. really fast. So it was kind of nice to just have a whole stretch of days where that was the only thing I did, and it was kind of peaceful.
Yeah. Sounds awesome.
Yeah.
So our theme today for this show is bad. Simply bad. Okay. So overall, for writing graphic novels, what parts would you say that maybe you're not necessarily the best at? Or just in general, what would be like a part of writing a graphic novel?
Well, writing panel so many times followed by a number really sucks. There's just like a lot of formatting. Like when you're writing prose, you can kind of get into the flow of the sentence and the language. And in comics, there's a whole lot of page one, panel one, character A, dialogue, dialogue, character B, dialogue, panel description. And then the, so there's just like, there's a lot of unromantic stuff that it just kind of feels more like work than a lot of other kinds of writing are. In terms of like scene types that I really am averse to writing, boy, writing action scenes is really dull. I mean, it's kind of interesting to like mentally plan them out, but writing, you know, as so-and-so throws a punch is just, there's not a whole lot of room for self-expression in there.
Got it. I know, like, writing Sunday comics, the actual panel layout can be relatively restrictive. Mm-hmm. Were you able to play around with something like that?
So it wasn't that my publisher was great. They pretty much let me get away with anything I wanted
Awesome.
Bless them. my editor was just like, sure, that's a great idea. And sometimes I was like, oh, please don't let me get away with that. But I've written for comic strips before. Okay. And I mean, the nice thing about them is that, you know, it's like telling a knock-knock joke. The format kind of tells you what sort of stories you can tell.
That totally makes sense.
For this one, since it was kind of free roam, I liked doing a lot of pages where there was maybe a bit of prose and an illustration instead of just all moment-to-moment comics panels or having the style change when a character is telling a story or is, you know, having a flight of fancy. The pictures change really radically and the layout style can change. So I really like varying things. In general, I try to keep the number of panels per page pretty low.
Okay.
So everything felt kind of peaceful.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So, bit personal, but like overall, maybe growing up and that sort of thing, what was your personal favorite graphic novel?
Oof. That's a cruel question.
Okay, maybe like top five or something.
Okay. What age range are we talking about here, though, really?
Anything you want.
Wow. 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 That is brutal. I mean, I was super lucky because I was a kid in the 90s when like Calvin and Hobbes and The Far Side and everything.
Calvin
like,
Hobbes.
Yeah, I know. I was there for it, man. I was at ground zero. So that was beautiful. But I mean, those weren't really long form stories. I think probably the first full length graphic novel I read was Mouse by Art Spiegelman,
which is
some pretty dark reading material for a 10-year-old.
Intense intro to the form.
Definitely. But he also does a lot of really fascinating stuff with the comics form. And it was just the format of the storytelling was really absorbing for me beyond the fact that the subject matter is so overwhelmingly important. Yeah. So that had a really big impact on me. As a teen in high school, I really loved Sandman, written by Neil Gaiman and illustrated by a ton of artists. Yeah, like I'm a gothy nerd, so like it's required by law that I have been a Sandman fan at some point.
Well, they're making a TV show now, so.
You know, they've said that like every 10 years for the last half century.
That's true. Although Good Omens maybe be able to segue into it.
Oh boy, that'd be real cool. I would be totally down with that. But no, there's so many books that have meant a lot to me at various points. It's really and there's so many more books now than there were when I was a kid. Like the number of age appropriate graphic novels was so slim, and now there's a gazillion of them, and it's I'm so jealous of kids today.
Okay, so what advice would you have to those interested in becoming graphic artists?
Boy, just go for it. Just keep drawing, keep writing. It's really helpful if you can draw your own material. Not everybody's interested. Some people really just do want to be illustrators and tell the visual story. But if you're able to at least come up with short stories of your own, it will give you a lot of insight into how to work with a writer even. Make friends who are also, I mean, that sounds like the dumbest thing, but, you know, as you move into like your post high school and teenage years, everybody tells you, you've got to learn how to network. What they don't tell you is that networking is actually just making friends with other people who are into the same stuff as you are.
That makes sense.
So make friends with folks who are kind of where you're at. Who have, you know, your skill level or slightly better. Most of my friends were more talented than me, which was very motivational.
Yeah.
but just keep doing work and put it online. There's like no barrier to entry at all to start learning and to be part of a community of creators. I get super excited when like a teenager comes up to me at a show or, you know, talks to me on social media and shows me their stuff or asks me advice. And I love it. Mm-hmm. People were so kind to me at that age, and comics in general are so welcoming of young people and young creators that you'll find a happy audience.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So is there anything overall that I didn't necessarily ask you but you'd want to talk about? Or
boy, so many things. What's up with this weather we're having right now? So tough.
Well, I'm from upstate New York, so this feels positively blissful.
Oh yeah, no, we have no humidity here. Congratulations. Everything's so easy by comparison. This book, having it come out now, is a little strange for me because I have another book that's completely the opposite of it coming out at the same time.
Okay.
From a Portland publisher, Oni Press, and it's called The Long Con, and the last issue came out today.
Oh, wow. Congrats.
Thank you. 10 issues, 2 books, and I co-wrote it. It has my co-writer is Ben Coleman, who works for the Portland Mercury here.
Okay.
And our artist is an incredible talent named Emily Denich. We had fantastic colorists and letters, so it was a team book, and it was the first time I'd ever worked on a book with that many people on it. And it's a very, like, dark comedy.
Okay.
Yeah, the apocalypse hits at Comic-Con. 5 years later, everybody's still alive inside, and they've just kind of kept the convention going. So it's a little bleak commentary on nerd culture.
That sounds really interesting.
Yeah, it's the exact opposite of this like lovely pastoral book that's all about like coming of age and discovering your true identity. So it was a little bit nuts to be doing two such different books at the same time, but I really loved the challenge and I loved having two different stories in my head at once. So don't be afraid of having diverse creative impulses.
What was it like working with just more than yourself for a graphic novel?
I really enjoyed it. It was really fun to have somebody else there when I run out of ideas, or who could, you know, go into a document and punch up the joke, make it a lot funnier than I would have ever thought of. And having such a talented artist and was awesome. She would add in jokes all on her own that I was just like, I would catch after it was published and be like, oh, that's brilliant. That's an anime joke. I get it now. So that was really cool.
That's awesome. Well, thank you very much for being here, Dylan, and congrats on the book.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much there for Dylan McConis, and we wish her luck for all future endeavors. Next up is Mika and Kai with a commentary on bad words.
Hi, my name is Mika Tomizawa.
And I'm Kai Tomizawa.
And today we will be talking about bad words.
I personally enjoy a bad word every once in a while. It emphasizes my points, and it can make me feel really empowered.
Whereas I don't use bad words, but that's, of course, just personal preference.
Whether you are an avid cusser or not, we are about to give you a breakdown of the origins of some of the most popular bad words.
Let's start out with the F word.
Not the hate speech F word.
The F word that rhymes with duck. So according to So Long As It's Words, a very long time ago, the F word meant to strike and to hit. But since then, it has evolved into a word used for having intercourse.
This is kind of interesting because other words for having intercourse can also mean to strike or to hit, including to nail or to bang. And this really ties into the original meaning of the F word.
Right.
I don't love this because it creates a very violent connotation for a loving act, in my opinion.
I agree. Next, we will be talking about the B word. The Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines the B word as a female dog, so that's the B word we're talking about.
Aside from the original meaning, it can mean a lewd or immoral woman, a malicious, spiteful, or overbearing woman, and or something that is extremely difficult, objectionable, or unpleasant.
According to the Oxford English Dictionary, the B word has been used to refer to female dogs since 1000 AD.
That's a long time.
But it was first used as a derogatory slur against women somewhere around the 15th century.
Our knowledge about the B word was collected on an awesome article from the Huffington Post, so
go check that article out. Next, we will be talking about the B word, another B word. This is the B word that, according to the Online Etymology Dictionary, means an illegitimate child or an acknowledged child of a nobleman by a woman other than his wife.
This is interesting because even though this word is used to insult a man, it is truly insulting his mother and disparaging female promiscuity.
Right. Next, we will be talking about the C word. This one is very derogatory, but this...
They're all pretty derogatory.
They're all pretty derogatory. This one strikes a certain place in my heart where it makes me cringe when I hear people say it. But this word, meaning vagina, is rooted in the Latin word cunnis, meaning sword sheath.
Okay, so this word, even though it was originally not used as an insult, I'm assuming, has always been used in a fairly misogynistic way. Mm-hmm. Because even the term sword sheath implies that the purpose of the vagina is a place to put your sword.
Yeah, and
if we're going to use that metaphor.
If we're going to use that metaphor. And going along with this metaphor, the sword is the weapon of power, whereas the vagina would just be...
The sheath.
The sheath. The protective barrier. Last word is the S word.
I love this word. It is easy to say, and it is also not super problematic in its origin. This word means poop now, and it meant poop then, so it's pretty consistent.
Mm-hmm.
Love you, S word. In the 14th century, it was used fairly commonly, meaning dung or diarrhea. So you would just say, oh, look at that stream. There's a lot of S word in it.
Mm-hmm.
And people...
Casually.
Yeah. And people knew what that meant, and so there's actually places in Europe that originally were named after the S word and have since been changed.
Yeah. So this has been the origins of 5 commonly known bad words. Hopefully you've learned something cool.
I've definitely learned something.
Yeah. And this has been Kai
and Mika
from the KBOO Youth Collective.
Go. Thank you very much to Kai and Mika. Sorry about that technical difficulties there. My next piece here is going to be about the political sphere, and I just want you to keep in mind, I'm trying to keep this as nonpartisan and neutral as possible, so try to keep that in mind when you listen to my point here, okay?
Good evening, KBOO. This is Thomas with the Youth Collective. Now, there are 3 things you should never discuss at a dinner table. Those are money, religion, and politics. But tonight we're going to discuss that 3rd thing. Politics. So, in modern America, there are 2 main competing philosophies, and these philosophies are represented in the Democratic and Republican parties. But today, the words Democratic and Republican, instead of being words to signify the belief that a federal government should or shouldn't have more power, they're just words that spark division and negativity. Now, personally, I'm trying to keep this piece as neutral and nonpartisan as possible. I just want to get this one point across. If a person goes into a room full of their opposing political views, instead of being listened to and there being a healthy debate or disagreement, there's just bitterness and belittlement. Now, if a member of the Republican Party was in a room full of members of the Democratic Party, they'd be called racists, they'd be called Nazis, and they'd be called any manner of things. And when these people are racists, Nazis, or any manner of terrible people, I totally understand that, but it happens the exact other way, too. Members of the Republican Party would call liberal-leaning people socialists, commies, or other offensive names they made up. Now, personally, I just find this absolutely deplorable from both sides, because the way our government is formatted, and it's so all the belief systems can have a chance to be heard. You know, that's why people run for office as independents and not hold allegiance to any parties. It's for policies. Now, when you participate in this division, the demonization of opposing or contracting views, this adds on to the political and bureaucratic gridlock. And, you know, the ironic part is, if you ask either party, both are going to mention how sick they are of the gridlock and politics and bureaucracy. And I just want to bring it a little closer to home for a second. Just a couple weeks ago, Oregon State Senator Brian Boquist, he left the state just to block a vote on a climate bill that was planning to reduce emissions. Now, I was doing a lot of research on this, and I was looking at articles that were both liberal and conservative-leaning, and in many conservative-leaning articles, there's a point brought up to counter it, that saying, years prior, Democratic state senators did the exact same thing to block a vote. And, you know, I don't know about you, but personally, this is still a terrible thing. It's just as bad a thing to do. You know, putting your power and using your power as an elected official to hold back a process used for the good of the people who elected you, it's just childish, you know? And no matter the party, both of them still committed these moral crimes. And just because your opponent exploited the rules doesn't give you permission to do the same. But, you know, there's still hope about it. You know, there's people who still hold the noble beliefs of working for the good of the people who elected you, such as former senator and Vietnam War veteran John McCain.
Let's return to regular order. We've been spinning our wheels on too many important issues because we keep trying to find a way to win without help from across the aisle. That's an approach that's been employed by both sides, mandating legislation from the top down without any support from the other side, with all the parliamentary maneuvers that requires. We're getting nothing done, my friends. We're getting nothing done.
And also, you know, from the other perspective, I want to make sure we get both views covered. There's also a Democratic candidate, too, Pete Buttigieg.
And I welcome all of those voices. We're talking about Americans who have been elected by their fellow Americans in order to lead and represent them. That's a healthy conversation, even if it turns some at some moments into a tug of war over strategy, or we're still hashing out exactly what the right answer is going to be.
You know, the fact that members of our society are alienating not only others, but themselves and their own party by causing these arguments, it's just morally absent. You know, our democracy was created in such a way that opposing views can and will be presented against each other in order to find the best solution to these problems. And sadly, our political sphere has just devolved into the badness of people playing the game of parties over policy. And us people at the bottom are the ones suffering most, as pawns in this game of chess that's leading our nation and world into chaos. Because when the elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Thomas, for that wonderful piece. Thank you guys for tuning in to the KBOO Youth Collective. Our next show is Hard Knock Radio. And to close us out tonight is Bad by Michael Jackson.
K-Boot Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, a night with Jana Jihad on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. Jana Jihad Tamimi, 13-year-old Palestinian activist, began recording, reporting on, and sharing her lived reality from the age of 7, shortly after two of her relatives were killed by Israeli forces. Jana now enjoys a global following, serves as ambassador of the South African Palestinian Children's Initiative, and has been awarded internationally for her media role. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, a night with Jana Jihad, on Monday, July 29th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1226 Southwest Salmon Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm at the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton is a monthly film series that benefits your community radio station. This month, we'll